Let's start out with an anecdote from January of 1989. On the 19th of January 1989, Erich Honecker, who was the head of state in East Germany, the general secretary of the SED, or Socialist Unity Party, who had 28 years earlier been one of the individuals directly responsible for constructing the Berlin Wall in 1961, stated in a speech that anti-fascist protection wall had been very important in establishing the peace in Europe and maintaining stability from that point on. It would remain, he said, as long as conditions which had led to its construction were not altered. In other words, as long as the East and West was divided. He predicted that the wall would stand for another 50 or 100 years. Now, there's no doubt that in January of 1989, Erich Honecker sincerely believed that the wall would remain in place for another 100 years. And no one had any reason to disagree. I can't imagine that anyone has claimed that they predicted that within that year the wall would open up and the two German states would be unified in a single republic. There was change going on in Russia, Eastern Europe, and Central Europe. But nobody expected the East German regime to go along smoothly with that. It seemed to be stable, and it seemed to be stricter and more committed than the other states. At most, people might have expected a transitional reform that would follow suit over a long period of time. But to everyone's surprise, within 1 year, that anti-fascist protection wall was opened and began to be removed. The East German Socialist Unity Party fell, and by October of 1990, the two Germanies had been reunited. There was really no indication of that in 1988-1989. The film that we'll be looking at, of course, was done much later, but takes place in 1984 with a postscript that takes place in 1989-1990. So the world that we're looking at is that of the East German state at its height, one might say, in the middle of the 80s. So the first thing we need to do is just do a quick survey of how things got to that point and what the basic conditions were within that state. We've already covered the events and issues of the period immediately after the Second World War, referred to as Zero Hour from 1945 to 1949, in laying out the foundation of the West German state. So for the basic details of that period, you can go back to the previous lecture recording. But let's take a look at some of the key issues there and just summarize some of those. First of all, we talked about the Russian methods of occupation in the Eastern Zone. It undertook a strict policy of denazification, which involved eliminating all leaders of former German politics and the economy, associating capitalism with National Socialism, according to the Marxist-Leninist interpretation of Nazism. Of course, it was also applying the tenets of Marxist-Leninism in constructing a supposedly communist economy. And in addition, it consolidated a single-party system along the lines of the communist system in Soviet Union, by forming a coalition between the Socialist Party and the Communist Party, referred to as the Socialist Unity Party, which would monopolize power in East Germany from that point on. Economically, we've talked about how the Soviet Union drew from the German territory as much as it could in the form of, quote, reparations, unquote, in return for the brutal German occupation of the Soviet Union during the war. And to do so, they dismantled almost every aspect of the East German economy. Factories, livestock, trees, completely taking over that economy. Now, this particular aspect of their policy didn't differ that much with what the Western forces were undertaking in their zones. Remember, the initial policy of the Western authorities was to transform Germany into a rural agricultural state according to the Morgenthau Plan, which would make sure that Germany would never rise up to trouble the international world again. Now, as we've seen, as a result of the Cold War conflict between the Soviet Union and Western nations, especially the United States, the Western policy shifted with the development of the Marshall Plan, infusing investment into Western Europe in general in order to establish an economic bulwark against the threat of communist communism spreading into an ineffective economy in Western territories. The establishment of a new currency in the West, which really isolated the German East German system. And triggered a drastic measure on the part of the Soviet policymakers, which was to blockade Berlin from the West altogether, starting in June of 1948 and lasting until May of 1949. Of course, this was the period of the Berlin airlift, where American pilots, for the most part, provided supplies to a city that was cut off from Western economies at the rate of, I have here, 8,000 tons a day, and earned the appreciation of many Berliners, especially young Berliners, from that point on. Now, after that comes the formal constitution of West Germany in May of 1949. And we've talked about that, headed by Adenauer of the conservative CDU. And after that, in October of 1949, the German Democratic Republic, GDR in English, and DDR in German, Deutsche Demokratische Republik, was established. Now, this competition went on either side, pressing to impose its system on the German population and earn the loyalty of each side. And in the long run, we can see that the East German system was not able to convince its citizens that it was superior. And although I'm a cultural historian and tried to emphasize the spiritual aspects of these things, there's really no doubt that it was the economic contrast that had the greatest impact on East Germany and ultimately led to its greatest difficulties and ultimate end. And this was clear really from the start, because as the economic miracle unfolded in the West, East Germans voted mainly with their feet. They simply started to get up and leave and migrate to the West. This was referred to during the period as the brain drain, because young people would obtain their education in a very fair and open system, at least as far as the opportunities for lower class people to get education, get their medical degrees, get their engineering degrees, get their technical degrees, and then move their families to the West. And so East Germany was suffering from this loss of the best and the brightest. That's what ultimately brought about the construction of the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall was not erected in order to keep the West out, in other words, to block Western forces from invading, although there certainly were Russian soldiers there ready to do that. The Berlin Wall was constructed to keep East Germans in, to keep them from fleeing to the West and pursuing their piece of the economic miracle. That's what was taking place on August 13, 1961, when, starting very early in the morning, East German border patrols and troops started literally building a wall that cut through the tripartite, now bi-zones of Berlin, and ultimately surrounded the whole of the West German territories, and then extended across the East German border to the south and west of Berlin. So the Berlin Wall was more than just a wall around Berlin, but a wall across the border, the zones, east and west, establishing real isolation for the inhabitants of the eastern territories. Now, I tell you this because I have encountered people who have either forgotten or simply aren't aware that when we talk about the Berlin Wall, we are talking about a physical wall. This was a wall of about 13 feet high, on average, I believe, about a foot and a half thick of concrete, poured concrete and rebar, with what's that stuff called at the top? Barbed wire is draped across the top, depending on where you were, death strips, referred to as death strips, usually on the East German side, of minefields, electronic surveillance, machine gun setup, guard towers, lights, dogs, a truly dangerous set of weaponry in order to keep East Germans from fleeing the Eastern Territory. By the way, the wall was constructed about 10 or 15 feet inside East German territory. They wanted to make sure that they didn't cross the border, thus triggering Western response. So if you were walking along the wall on the western side, you were actually walking in East German territory, and East German guards would yell down to you or point to you that you should get back away from the wall. And in strict international legal terms, they were correct. You were walking on East German territory, but most people didn't pay too much attention to that on the west side. Now, within the East German world, as I've said, the political system was dominated by a single party whose leadership answered primarily to Moscow. It worked hard to legitimate itself through intense Marxist-Leninist rhetoric. And I can confirm that because I did work on Beethoven interpretation in East Germany, and every concert review, every concert brochure, every analysis published about Beethoven's person or Beethoven's music was just littered with this Marxist interpretation of his music, of his biography, of the social circumstances behind his life and his work. It's not that all of this was inaccurate. Much of it was based on certain aspects of Beethoven's experience, drawing conclusions from very selective aspects of that, which is true of just about any politicized interpretation of the music. But it was universal. There were no contrary views, and it was just constantly crammed down their throats, this Marxist-Leninist perspective on, in this case, music, but just about every aspect of social existence. Now, whether or not this ideology, which is fascinating from a cultural historical point of view, it's interesting to try to draw connections between Nazi ideology and propaganda methods and East German ideology and propaganda methods, even though they came from the opposite ends of the spectrum. In the end, I have to admit that the real issues were economic. And in this, there's no doubt that life was much grayer, much more dreary, much less satisfying in the East than it was in the West. Here are just a few elements of that. Following the economic model of the Soviet Union, the East German economy was centrally planned. All properties and business were sort of placed under state control. And in the long run, this system did not function as effectively as the West German competitive market did. Every object was created by design from some sort of central planner. I can tell you some other memories, but for instance, the production of shoes. Every shoe had, for the most part, the same sole. All that they would change would be, according to fashion, would be the top that was attached to that sole. So you can see how they tried to keep up with the West with certain kinds of tennis shoes, certain kinds of track shoes, and so on and so forth. But you looked at it, and the sole was exactly the same. There wasn't any competition to create a better sole. They had those. They formatted them. They pumped them out. And then they would just simply put a different canvas or leather top on it. It looked kind of funny from Western perspective, but it was certainly indicative of this sort of centralized planning and its inability to be flexible. Here are some statistics from The Economist regarding household equipment in 1988, comparing Eastern with Western German statistics. In 1988, 90% of Western German households had a car, 97%. In the East, 52%. In the West, 94% had color TVs. In the East, again, 52%. In the West, 98% had a telephone. And in the East, I'm reading here, only 7% had a telephone. Thinking back, of course, my experience, everyone's experience trying to call and contact someone over in the East was indicative of this statistical reality. It was very hard to reach through. Only certain number of calls were allowed through at any particular time or maybe per day. And if you were in the West and had an appointment, you would have to try numerous times to get through and make to confirm that, maybe over a week. Before you could actually connect with someone. So that was a hard reality. Now, looking at these statistics, 52% had cars, 52% had color TVs, that also should take into account the fact that the quality of these objects that they did have was certainly inferior to that which the Western households enjoyed. And the most obvious example of that are the cars. The most famous symbol of East German economy was the Trabi, or Trabant, which was this little three-stroke automobile that they produced out of pressed cardboard, essentially, with a shellac over the top of it. And people would wait for years and years to obtain one of those cars. They were very, you know, glad to get them, and that amounted to the 50% of families that owned them. But they were certainly nothing compared to the automobiles being produced by Mercedes-Benz, Audi, BMW in the West, and so forth. Just a few recollections of the major differences between East and West German economies and environments. One thing that I noticed right away was that when you went over to the East, and if you were able to obtain a seat in a bar or a nightclub, by the way, they only had limited supplies for any night, so they could only accept a certain number of clients, and once that number had been reached, they wouldn't let anybody else in the door. So I remember a number of occasions where East German friends were trying to show me a good time, and we just went from place to place and weren't able to even get a beer. But when we were, the beer didn't even taste good. And to me, that was a sure sign that something was wrong, because if Germans weren't producing good beer, there was certainly something completely demoralized about the culture. Along with drinking, one of the things that every Westerner noticed was that at any social function, whether it be at a reception for some sort of university or government occasion, I was invited to a number of those, or let's say a reception at a concert event, a music event, or if you just went into one of the better cafes along Unter den Linden, the main street in what was then East Berlin. They always served the same refreshment, and that was an artificial orange drink. It was not citrus based, because they did not have access to tropical fruit of any kind. It was an artificial kind of orange drink, and you would drink this with little toasts with a kind of cream cheese and an olive on the top. And no matter what kind of function you went to, this is what was served. Seemed to be ubiquitous. And, the punchline to this story is that after the wall did open, one of the companies that went in and made a quick profit before things changed too much was Tang. Because in comparison to the artificial orange drink that was being produced in East Germany, Tang was absolutely delicious. So they went in there very quickly before Eastern Europeans had an opportunity to taste fresh squeezed orange juice or juice from concentrate. And Tang was very popular for a short period there. Now, the ultimate slap in the face in East Germany, as well as other Eastern European countries, was the fact that they knew the difference for the most part. Part of that was through access to Western television, so that they could see there the advertising and the Western world that was depicted in even American shows that were broadcast in the West. And, of course, this was something that the East tried to control, but perhaps didn't control enough in the long part. One of the funny phenomena of Eastern towns was that they would build these antennae in order to obtain Western broadcasts, and in low-lying towns and valleys further to the east, they would erect these really tall antennae to try to get those signals. So you could see the effort that they made in order to get information about the West. But they didn't even have to look that far, because in every city there were intershops where you could buy Western goods if you had Western currency. And in there they had the best watches and the best cigarettes and the best pens and the technology and most of the luxury goods that Westerners enjoyed. And this drove Easterners crazy. It was a way for the Soviet nations to obtain some hard currency from Western visitors, and but it was basically a black market run by the government, and there they could see the things that they were looking for, or things that they were missing, I should say. As you walked around East Germany, you could see the disrepair, dead construction sites at which it seemed no one had been working for years, unfinished apartment buildings, not painted since the war. Of course, it was fascinating historically to walk around in areas and see shrapnel holes in the walls, or even machine gun holes in the walls that hadn't been repaired since 1945. Bartering was really the only way to get things done. You had to trade with tradesmen and carpenters and so on, and that was a long process often. Really scary was the extent of pollution in the East, and this was a major issue when the East and West were unified. Western environmentalists were really concerned about what had taken place in eastern rivers, and immediately worked to try to reverse those things. Western German environmental policy, brought about by the Greens over the last 20 years or so, were quickly imposed on the East, and I can tell you, it looked to me like they really needed it. First of all, they burned brown coal, in order to, which is a cheap kind of coal, in order to heat their apartment. So as soon as you went over to the East, you could smell the difference. It smells much, very stringent, and kind of burns your nose. So this brown coal was being burned, and if you went into the smaller towns out in the outskirts of that, you'd see factories with open cans of chemical waste just sitting in what looked like dump sites, and it looked like the stuff was pouring out into the streets. And you know, you really, even if you're not even that concerned with the environment, were struck by what appeared to be a potential for an environmental catastrophe over there. When you crossed over, you were given, required to change a certain amount of money for your day's stay, and as I recall, it was 40 marks, which was then was something like $25 or something like that. Well, that might not seem so bad, but you weren't able to bring any of that out, so you had to figure out a way to spend it in the East, and the problem was that there really wasn't much to spend it on. So everybody usually ended up at the Karl Marx bookstore, which is actually featured in the film. That was down at the other end of Unterdenlinden, and you would rummage around there looking for some books to buy. Well, this was another indication of how little there was in terms of a consumer society, because there were, you know, very few contemporary books. What there were classics, and then Marxist-Leninist treatises on just about anything you can imagine, as well as calendars that featured East German construction accomplishments, tractors, production, agricultural production. In other words, not exactly the kind of calendar that you want to hang up in your dorm room. Now, this wasn't just a result of the economic policies, but this was an indication of the cultural control that was imposed on the East German side. Crossing over, you were checked very carefully to make sure that you weren't bringing over any West German materials or Western materials or American books, magazines of any kind. This also manifested itself at the state library. That's where I would go and do work. And I was looking actually for the most part for East German materials. But in the Staatsbibliothek, the main library, state library, on Unter den Linden as well, I also had a reason to search through some other things that were only in the East. The German libraries, the Berlin libraries, had been split at the end of the war, one in the East and the one in the West. They had the card catalog in the West, but they had most of the materials in the East. So you would search for your reference numbers in the West, and then you had to go over to the East in order to see if they could find them. Anyway, so I was looking for some materials that weren't readily available to East German citizens, and these were made were accessible only in what was known as the poison room, the Giftkammer. And there they did have Western materials in this single room of the library. They had the Der Spiegel, West German magazine, West German newspapers, and they also that's where they had materials from the Nazi period and other historical resources. But this was a room where only people like myself, Westerners or East Germans with very specific clearance, were able to work. And I don't know if what it was used for, but I do remember that was it was a very small room. Maybe 25 people could sit in there at most at tables, and the door had a window on it. I don't know if they were actually peering in or it was just symbolic of the possibility that they were peering in. But, you know, it's very likely that they were monitoring, especially what East Germans were looking at in there. This, for me, was probably the clearest manifestation of the kind of monitoring that was going on in the East. I'm sure that my friends were much more concerned about it than I was, since they were hosting me. I do remember speaking a little bit too loudly in a cafe with one of my friends, and he sort of indicated to me that he wasn't comfortable with that. And I realized how unconscious I was of that sort of thing. I don't even know if I was talking about East German politics, but maybe used some names of West German politicians. And he simply indicated that I should keep my voice down when I speak about those kinds of things. Other than that, I do remember seeing cameras on the streets in East Germany. Of course, now we have cameras all over the street in Chicago, so things have progressed one way or the other, I guess. But that was in a particular area right off of Unter den Linden near the wall, and it was the area in which the Stasi building and other intelligence agencies were operating. So, you know, of course you have security cameras on the outside of American government buildings at all. Perhaps we're projecting our own, some sort of fear on the East German citizen when we look at East German security cameras. But obviously, as the film indicated, the use of surveillance in order to acquire information that could be used in order to control the citizenry of East Germany was a constant in this world. I'll leave it to our resources to tell you a little bit more about this, but I think it's important to point out that after the first decade, we'll say, the mode of terror applied to East German citizens was not as physical as had been the case under Nazi Nazi system, but rather psychological and economic. Now, to be sure, hundreds, if not thousands, of those deemed political opponents to the Soviet occupation were physically arrested and eliminated in the first years of the occupation, and an individual could certainly lived in constant fear of losing one's freedom as well as one's life. And obviously extreme cases, East German citizens could be arrested and spend extended periods of time in jail. But for the most part, the threat was one of occupational terror. If one stepped out of line, if one was heard stating anti-Soviet positions, if one made jokes about the regime, or if one was seen to speak too highly of the West or make indications that one might be interested in fleeing to the West or helping others to flee the West, so on and so forth. What was jeopardized was the possibility for any advance in one's career, or perhaps losing any position that one had in that career and being set back. One manifestation of this was the fact that a number of, let's say, more active, critical students at universities, if you were outspoken in any way at the university, you wouldn't be accepted into any of the programs that might lead to some sort of financial security or success or status positions within the state. But one could only take theology. And as a result, you have this influx of a lot of radical thinking, sort of outgoing personalities in theology, which in the long run explains why a lot of the critical voices and critical activities came out of the evangelical church, out of the Protestant church. It wasn't just because of the principles of the church, but it was because they had sort of created a community of critical thinking ministers through this policy. That's one theory that I've read. But it's just an indication of the sort of occupational or an economic pressure that was put on people to conform, in addition to the more extreme. But this would have been more common within the East German system for your average citizen than perhaps you might imagine. So that's a sketch with some personal reflections on conditions in East Germany as a result of leadership of the SED backed by the Soviet hierarchy. Now let's just talk a little bit before we look at the movie about the process that led to the end of the East German regime. In the background to what came to be known as the transition or Wende in East Germany was the development of reform movements in East Bloc countries ever since the mid-70s. Probably the most famous of these were the Solidarity movement in Poland and some of the activities of people like Václav Havel in the Czechoslovakia, and other less known efforts in Hungary. These are the real, you know, heroes of all of this who really worked against all odds to try to bring about some reforms and bring the message of their plight to international attention. But through 1985, there was no indication that this was going to have any effect on Soviet policy or the policy of the nations in question. But in 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev came to power in the Soviet Union. Now, this isn't the place to go into any depth about Gorbachev or his background in the Soviet system and how he actually got there. But suffice it to say that his policies of perestroika, an opening up of the economy, his awareness that the Soviet economy was in trouble, and also the need to really moderate this international tension that required the Soviet Union to put so much of its resources into the military and so forth, did lead to significant change. And this manifested itself not just in the Soviet Union, but in Poland and in Hungary. Czechoslovakia as well. But nobody expected change to take place in the East Germany. The Honecker regime really seemed to be one of the strict application of Soviet principles. It had a certain amount of independence now as one of the more staunch of the authoritarian systems. And people, it was assumed that even if the Soviet Union opened up, it would stand alone, at least under the leadership of Honecker and his immediate followers. I have a quote here that the government indicated that it would not follow the new line offered by Moscow. They saw it as selling out the revolution to capitalist imperialist threats. When confronted with these changes, their response was maddening. An elderly member of the Politburo said, quote, "If your neighbor put up a new wallpaper in his house, would you feel obliged to put up new wallpaper in yours?" End of quote. So, although these changes were taking place in Russia and in Hungary and Poland, Germany seemed to be immune to Gorbachev's changes. However, events ran ahead of this government. What took place between Honecker's speech in January of 1989 and the opening in November, is known as the Summer of Flight. What happened was that a new government started to reform in the Gorbachev spirit policies in Hungary. Under Grosch, like George Grosch, the government issued a policy that no refugee could be returned by force to a country where their life would be threatened. And when this was announced, East German, as well as other Polish and Czechoslovakian tourists who were able to go to Hungary interpreted this as a possibility that they would be able to go to Hungary and establish themselves as refugees. And so they started to use their vacation privileges to go to Budapest. And after that, the same sort of policies were announced in Prague and Warsaw. So what you had were members of certain East European bloc countries going to other Eastern European bloc countries in order to obtain this refugee status. And through that summer, May, June, July of 1989, these embassies were inundated with refugees, many of whom were from East Germany. And you may see films or photographs of that. I don't know if any of you remember it, but these the embassy grounds were just full of these people who were climbing over the fences and getting into the embassy areas and camping out, and there became, you know, concern for hygienic problems, and people had to be fed, and it was just overwhelmed the system in each of these sites. But finally, the Hungarian government first allowed East German vacationers, quote-unquote, to cross over the border into Austria. I have here that in the first 3 days, 15,000 East Germans crossed into Austria. This was a sign that change was really possible. What was most important was that in response to Hungary's action, a Soviet government spokesman merely called it unusual. And with that indication that Gorbachev's government wasn't going to try to stop this, East Germans started to flock into Hungary, Poland, and Czechoslovakia. By September 14, some 30,000 East Germans had fled over this route. And they, again, were overwhelming the embassies in the East. And ultimately, the pressure from them caused the East German government to authorize these escapees, what they called escapees, Flüchtlinge, yeah, escapees, to go out of those embassies and into the West. Their argument was that they were just letting these social undesirables out. Now, the terrifying thing for those who were involved was that the East German government required that they do so by crossing back into East German territory on special trains so that they could be officially expelled. And this was terrifying because the people who got onto those trains weren't sure if they were actually going to be expelled. Right? And also because as these trains passed through East Germany, other people attempted to get onto them and stood and watched them go by and referred to them as freedom trains and so on and so forth. And the authorities had to fight to keep these people from getting near those trains. So there was a particularly tense period that resulted from really these Hungarian, the Czechoslovakian, and Polish decisions to allow these vacationers to go out. I remember I was just going to Germany during that period as these individuals were leaving Hungary and then coming back up, and strangely enough were ending up living in West Berlin. So they were going out of Hungary and then going back up and going back into West Berlin to live. And it was almost impossible to find apartments because of that. And the West Berlin was being inundated and overcrowded with these East German escapees. Of course, they wanted to get back and get close to their family members, and being in West Berlin was the most effective way to do that. At any rate, after, 28 years, the brain drain that had been stopped by the Berlin Wall had begun again. Because, of course, it was young families and professionals who were most able and willing to make the flight. Now, as this was going on, there were important developments taking place in East Germany, triggered by the awareness of things that were going on in the Soviet Union and in Hungary and Poland and Czechoslovakia, but also these escape or these vacation escapees, the summer of flight. And what you had was the coming out more and more vociferously of reform groups, principally within various Protestant churches. Most famously, Monday night services served as the catalyst for this action. Right? And here's just a sort of sketch of some of these. On September 1st, hundreds demonstrated in front of the Nikolaikirche in Leipzig, which is still known as the central place of origin of this reform movement. Their placard saying "Freedom to travel instead of mass flight" were ripped from them by security police. So the police are still coming down hard on them. On 11 of September, a group called the New Forum was formed. And on that night, 70 demonstrators were arrested after church services at the Nikolaikirche again. So, still talking about tens, hundreds of demonstrators. But 2 weeks later, on 25th of September, 8,000 demonstrators in Leipzig demanded the recognition of New Forum as a legitimate political organization. So you have 8,000 demonstrators there. And by the 2nd of October, there was a demonstration of 25,000 in Leipzig. Right, so within 2 months, you've gone from just a sprinkling of very brave but isolated reformers to demonstrations of up to 25,000, which the state's police were still putting down violently, and mass arrests were taking place. Now, all of this is incredibly ironic, because in October of 1989, the East German regime was preparing to celebrate its 40th anniversary. So, quite a landmark. 7th of October 1989 was going to be the celebration of the 40th anniversary of East Germany. So they were preparing all the classic parades, meetings, speeches that were part of East German Soviet propaganda. And by the way, Gorbachev was scheduled to appear. And for those of us who were in Berlin at the time, it was tremendously symbolic. These things were broadcast on television, and on the surface, it seemed like, despite all these things that were going on in the background, there was still general support for the regime, because they were able to put on this propaganda show of people marching by Honecker, marching by Gorbachev, doing all the things that had been done traditionally to mark East German patriotism. But if you looked closely, you could see that, for instance, as people were marching by the podium where Gorbachev was singing, they were yelling out, "Help us, Gorby." And Gorbachev did help to a certain degree, because although not too blatantly, he made it clear that he too was awaiting changes in the GDR, because in his speech he said almost directly to Honecker, "He who comes late is punished by life." And then, according to a communist tradition, he put a kiss on the lips of Honecker. And all the newspapers in the West, anyway, ran that as a kiss of death, that he was, you know, essentially saying, "Honecker, your time is up, and you need to move forward, or you're going to be punished by life." Now, what people didn't see in the Western, couldn't see in the Western coverage of this, or in the coverage of it at all, was the fact that behind the scenes, demonstrations were for reform were occurring, and that thousands were calling for reform, trying to get Gorbachev's attention, and that they were attacked by security forces, thousands being arrested, as just at the very same time that those official commemorations were taking place. 2 days later, in Leipzig, on the 9th of October, 50,000 demonstrators went out, standing up against what they call the hypocrisy of the 40th anniversary celebrations. At this point, they were the government was certainly not about to bend, at least not officially. In fact, plans were in place that were referred to as the Tiananmen, or the Chinese option, because previously in that year, the bloody repression of the demonstrators in Tiananmen Square had taken place. According to the spy chief, Marcus Wolf, there was a written order from Honecker for a Chinese solution. It could have been worse than Beijing. So, as far as the hardliners in the regime itself were concerned, this reform movement was not going to be allowed to continue, let alone have effect. But we know now that at that time, Soviet officers made it clear to East German authorities that they would not order their troops to interfere. And this is the key symbol, that and it probably did go back to Gorbachev, although I've not read the specific details of this, but that the Soviet army was not going to back up a Chinese solution on the part of the East German leadership. And this really, in a sense, was the key, the pivotal decision, probably coming from the top of Soviet authorities, that meant that the revolution would unfold in a peaceful rather than a violent way. From that point, the demonstrations grew larger and larger. By the 16th of October, crowds of 200,000 were gathering in Leipzig, all pressuring for the resignation of Honecker and reform of the SED. And on October 18, Honecker did offer his resignation, quote, for health reasons, end quote. Now, Honecker was an old and maybe perhaps sickly leader. So his resignation was probably pro forma and might have taken place after the 40th anniversary anyway. Hard to say. But it wasn't the complete opening that the demonstrators were hoping for. I'm not going to go into all of the details of this, but initially the person who replaced him was a younger guy named Egon Krenz, who from the outside looked refreshing enough, but to insiders was just an indication that they were going to try to keep to pawn this off as a transition, but maintain for the most part the same policies. He had been a head of internal security forces. He was implicated in the fixing of elections. He had said things about using the communist option, the Chinese option to deal with the demonstrators. He tried to back off on these things, but they weren't going to have any of it. On the 4th of November, 1989, a million persons turned out in East Berlin for a demonstration calling for freedom of the press, freedom of opinion, and free elections. It's in that week that it's probably not the most important aspect of the transition that was taking place, but certainly the most visible indication of change took place. The Politburo met to try to bring about a certain number of reforms in response to these changes. And on November 9, they came out with a series of decisions that were made. And none of these were earth-shattering in and of themselves. Basically, bureaucratic personnel changes, a list of 7, 8, 9 things that they had just discussed during the day. And in the midst of this list, perhaps point number 7 or 8, the party spokesman indicated that East Germans would be allowed to travel across their borders with visas to be issued immediately. I remember watching this press conference, and of course it's fairly famous now. After going through the whole list, one of the reporters raised their hands and said, "Well, could we go back to point number 7? Could you repeat that?" And they did. And they said, "Well, would that also apply to West Germany, West Berlin crossings?" And the spokesman sort of looked around and said, "Yeah, I suppose." And that was it. They went on to further business. Now, over the next few hours, people tried to interpret what had taken place there. There hadn't been any sort of grand announcement. There was just this sort of subtle, bureaucratic, offhand reference to the possibility of crossing over at the borders on demand. I remember calling back and forth to friends, trying to see, asking if they had seen this, and they all had, and they wondered what it meant, and they, you know, weren't sure. We'll have to see. You know, it sounded like, though, that they said that something major had just been decided. So I decided that the place to be, if any of this was in fact an indication that they were going to open up the border crossings, was the Brandenburger Gate. We've talked about the Brandenburger Gate back there in the beginning of the 19th century and the symbolism of that as a neoclassical indication of 19th century German governance. So I thought that would be the place to go, since that really is the symbolic center of Berlin. So my wife and I went down there at about 8 o'clock after dinner and stood there, and there really wasn't that much to report. There were a few other people who felt the same way. They had lit candles in front of the west side of the wall, and some were singing right-wing songs. There were some neo-fascists there calling for unification. But as we peered into the East German side, there wasn't any indication that anything special was going on. So it got to be 10, 11, and nothing was happening, and I had to get up and work on my dissertation the next morning. It was starting to get past my bedtime, so we got back on the train and went home. Well, one detail that we weren't aware of was that it was an indication that this new policy would take hold at midnight. So apparently all the same things were going on the east side. People were talking to each other, trying to interpret what this announcement had meant, or this non-announcement had meant, and were trying to decide how they were going to act. But at midnight, they went to the crossing guards and the border guards at the crossings, and indicated that they knew that this decision had been made, and lo and behold, the guards opened up and let them go through, and the Berlin Wall was breached. And I'm sure you're aware of all the celebrations that took place as Westerners or Easterners flowed into the West and climbed up on the wall and spilled each other with champagne and started taking the wall apart as East German border guards stood there and watched, sometimes confused and often bemused. Well, I found out about all of this the next morning when my wife and I turned on the radio and discovered that we'd missed one hell of a party. But on the other hand, the experience that we had of going down to the city immediately that morning and seeing not so much the midnight revelers, but the average East German families with small kids coming out of the S-Bahn stations, taking their first step outside of East German territory, was very moving. I'll never forget seeing those faces beaming as they walked with their washed out East German Levi or East German denim outfits and funky looking tennis shoes, and just wandering around in happy awareness that they weren't going to have to live in that gray, rather boring world anymore. And I'll say that's essentially what one could perceive, because there's no question that they were most excited about was the opportunity to go shopping. Now, certainly there was more to it than that, but after the first steps in Western freedom, they started to go to the shops and go to the stores, and they were given a certain amount of spending money in the next weeks, and it was amazing to watch how they just inundated all of the Western stores, buying not fancy things, very modest things, but things like fresh fruit, foods that they hadn't had access to before, I remember things like kiwis and bananas and oranges were completely sold out because they simply hadn't had those things before. So it started out with very basic elements and then progressed from there. Well, I'm an hour into this sort of summary of the East German experience, and so I'm going to stop there without going through all the details of how the transition unfolded from there, leading to ultimately the unification of Germany in October. But you can take a look at that material in Orlo, and trace the the shift, which is, and the most important aspect of that is the fact that what was initially a movement targeting reform of East Germany while maintaining their East German state very quickly became a shift toward unification of the two German states into a single German Republic. And, of course, there at the time, this was very controversial. And in the long run, probably isn't, but is an indication of how Helmut Kohl and the CDU, the conservatives in the West, took advantage of the opportunity that they saw and speeded up the agenda, thus bringing about within a year something that even at the time, in the midst of this reform movement, people didn't think would happen for another 5, 10, even 20 years. The goal of the reformers was to construct a state that maintained the positive aspects of Eastern Germany, the equal social system, the freedoms of women, a lot of the social services that were existed there, while eliminating some of the more drastic aspects of the regime. There's no question that the goal was this sort of third way, with a left wing that was again trying to maintain some space between itself, the Western capitalist orientation, and the Soviet mode of communist control. In the end, though, they were simply washed away in the rush toward first economic union by through another currency reform, incorporating the East German economy into the Western economy, and then ultimately elections that led to unification in October of 1990. So once again, that romantic leftist perspective on how Germany might be something other than a Western liberal economic nation and economy was ignored, you might say. Now, the movie we're going to see, you will have seen already, but I'm going to go through it here and try to add some comments. Largely speaks for itself, and I don't think it'll take that much interpretation, at least it's not as much as the symbolism of Maria Braun. It's not an art movie. It's a narrative story done in, quote, Hollywood style, unquote, which accounted for its popularity. And doesn't involve as much, or doesn't require as much interpretation as Fassbinder's more complex cinema did. So it doesn't. I don't think I'll have to say as much about what each of these scenes means. But the background reading that I've provided to you. The article by Timothy Garton Ash, the article by Anthony Lane, even the article by William Buckley, provides you know, some context for this. And I think the most important point to be drawn from it is, first of all, that the filmmaker himself was only 16 years old in 1989, and he's a Westerner, did not actually directly experience the East German regime. The actor who plays the Stasi agent was a citizen of the East German Republic and the German Democratic Republic, and was actually engaged with the reform efforts in 1989. So he knew this world very well, and certainly brings a good sense of its atmosphere in his performance. The general environment that the film depicts is held to be quite accurate. The kind of physical existence that East Germans lived under. But of course, most important here is the issue of the Stasi surveillance of East German citizens, and the policies by which it imposed this economic, if we will, professional, occupational terror on dissidents and those that deemed threats either to flee or to act for reform. As Timothy Garton Ash writes most effectively, being one of the most important scholars of the period, having written specifically about East German surveillance policy, specifically about his own file and the involvement of people he knew when he was visiting there in the 70s. So someone who really knows this material well. As he indicates, the Stasi has come to be a real symbol for the extremes to which German ingenuity can be applied in order to gather information about political opponents. And, of course, the extent to which the Stasi worked to gather this information and the amount of information that it did gather is legendary. I recently visited, or when I went to Washington and Baltimore, I went to the Spy Museum there, and a great amount of the information that they have there is about the East German system. Partly because it was so extreme, partly because it was so well documented, as Ash indicates. The mountains of information that they had on everybody, the extent to which they used friends, family, divided them among themselves in order to gather information, usually using this kind of economic and professional pressure on people. The use of extreme techniques such as the surveillance that's depicted here in the film, but also, you know, absurd things like gathering smells of individuals so that they could be searched for using guard dogs, and that anybody, thousands if not hundreds of thousands of vials with swabs of a human smell were maintained and meticulously recorded. As Timothy Garton Ash indicates, he had a file of over 350 pages. A single, at that time, college-age scholar living there generated that much attention from the Stasi. You can imagine what someone from East Germany with a, you know, more high-profile dissident status might have generated, literally thousands of pages on particular individuals with friends, lovers, family members reporting on them. So, as a case study in government surveillance of individuals, of course, the Stasi system in East Germany is highly symbolic. The interpreters of the film in these background readings indicate there are some exaggerations, some misrepresentations of some of the details here. But in the long run, they feel it stands up as an indication of the extremes to which the East German government went in order, remember, simply to maintain itself. for the most part, to keep people from fleeing to the West. That's really the fundamental issue. And, of course, to protect its reputation vis-a-vis the West. The pivotal issue that the director has used here is that of suicides in the East. And I guess that stands for every aspect of the East that might have triggered those kind of statistics that he uses as the basis for the article that the author is producing. But the particular case that triggers that act on the part of the author in the film is the suicide of his friend, who kills himself because of his inability to progress as an artist, to have his works produced. So he's under this occupational pressure, this occupational terror, and that triggers his self-destruction. So it's symbolic of that particular theme in most intensively. So anyway, those are some of the things that we can look for in the film that I think the film draws out pretty directly, and that you could certainly construct an essay or interpretation around. So I'm just going to look through the film and highlight some themes as it goes by. I don't know if I'll have time to cover the whole thing, but you'll be watching the whole film this afternoon, and most of these things are articulated in cinematic format pretty clearly.